we may as well start. My name is Jim Bull. I'm from the University of Texas. And most of what I do is play games with bacteriophage, which are a type of virus that kill bacteria. So I'm here as an experimentalist. And I guess my interests are really in sort of very gross level properties of our understanding of evolution and what we can apply without actually a whole lot of data gathering to understand and predict how systems, how perhaps viruses will evolve. This has nothing to do with my talk, but I think there's actually an up-and-coming niche for evolutionary biologists, application. So I think we all understand synthetic biology is upon us now, and people are synthesizing things left and right. And we have the ability now to make all kinds of bad things and good things and so on. And the one thing I can say as an outsider is right now it's an engineer's game, right? They're trying to understand how can we engineer to do things. They're not giving much thought to how these things can evolve. They're self-replicating in most cases, and what's going to happen when these self-replicating things get released into the environment, get released into a chemostat, get released in an algal pond. And so I think there's actually an opportunity for people that understand evolution to sort of work with these people and try and predict things. As one example, that's on the bad side of things, is I think it's Ron Jackson's lab in Australia, Canberra. They were working with mice. Australia has a mouse problem, believe it or not. And so they have big mouse plague from time to time. And they were trying to engineer mousepox virus to sterilize mice. So the idea would be, we'll release this virus and it'll sterilize mice, and so our mouse problem will be solved. That's probably what they told funding agencies. And so they put in an interleukin gene into mousepox, thinking that would somehow trigger the immune system, mouse immune system to, I don't know, somehow sterilize itself. And they popped this into mice, and it killed them. They popped this into mice that were immunized against mousepox, it killed them. They popped this into mice that were genetically resistant to mousepox, and it killed them. And at that point, they shut the whole thing down and published it and said, look, you know, this is bad. But it illustrates the potential here. And the question we as evolutionary biologists would ask is, if we release this thing, would the gene have stayed in the genome, would be one question. How would that virus evolve? But we're going to be faced with all kinds of things like this. And I think, you know, we'd like to think, well, the government's going to oversee all of this and make sure we don't do anything bad. But I just think there's so much of it going on that we really need to, you know, evolutionary biologists would sit down with these people and say, okay, what can we actually say? How much data do we need? Anyway, that's a complete aside. I want to talk about evolution and high mutation rates. And the motivation for this, you might think, well, it's an interesting question, and it is at some level, but there's more of an applied motivation. And that is, in the last couple decades, virologists have decided that elevating the mutation rates of viruses might be a way of curing infections. That is, if we can treat someone with a drug that elevates mutation rate, contrary as it might seem, we might be able to sort of swamp the viral population with so many bad mutations that it eventually craps out. And I think probably most virologists know this concept. If you do a web search for lethal mutagenesis and virus, you get, I don't know, there's something like 600 to 700 papers on the phenomenon. There's certainly a cadre of virologists that have pushed this a lot. Interestingly, our bodies are ahead of us in this respect. We carry a bunch of genes that actually do this. There's genes called AlphaVac genes, and they hammer single-stranded DNA, correct me if I'm wrong, somebody, with full of mutations, and it's thought that those have actually been a defense against certain types of viruses in our evolutionary history.
What are they called?
AlphaVac.
Yeah, they deanimate RNA.
Yeah, I know, it's like, is that right?
Single-stranded DNA.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm rest assured that whatever I say that's wrong will be immediately corrected.
Can bet on that.
And there was a, you know, there was also an issue of the Virology Journal, not one of the top journals in the field, that was devoted to lethal mutagenesis a few years back. So it's an idea that's gained a lot of attention. The reality is that right now there's most, I think, one drug that actually works this way. It's called ribavirin. And ribavirin is, it's kind of a mystery as to how it works. I think there might be at least five different mechanisms by which it suppresses viral reproduction inside a person. Only one of those is mutagenesis, but at least in culture they've shown that ribavirin has a mutagenic effect. And so I think this has really fueled a lot of the interest, even though there's just one. Now, I know there's someone named Lou Mansky who works with HIV, and he may have a second one that's actually working that way. So, but it's not like we can sit down and easily design, you know, say, okay, I want to make a drug that's going to mutate viruses. So it's more hit and miss, but the reason we might want to study this is to understand more about the process to figure out, you know, is this actually a strategy worth pursuing? And I'm focusing here on viruses pushed to high mutation rate. Paul Snagowski, a couple weeks ago, talked about his system, which is a bacterial system in which he's engineering bacteria to have high mutation rates. And I actually think that's got a lot of promise because there, you know, you have the potential to build in senescence to a bacterial system. And so if you want to release something into the environment, his approach actually might be a little bit different. The virus end is a little bit different. So, an outline for the talk is I want to give some background. Then I'll talk about a simulation study, an empirical study, and then I'll end on a single slide of yet another empirical study that might be considered a high point. But I want to give some background about these concepts. And I am well aware that everything I'm going to talk about here is understood by most of you better than it is by me. So again, I realize you don't need an invitation, but feel free to correct me if I go astray here. I'm going to keep things very simple. And I can also offer a little bit of warning to my friends in the audience that I will not hesitate to call on you to bail me out when I get into trouble. I want to start with mutation selection balance. This goes back to Nick's talk on Monday. In 66, Kimura and Maruyama have published a paper on mutation load. And pretty much buried in the paper is a result that I want to use. It's one that Nick brought up in his talk. And it concerns a specific fitness landscape. It's asexuals, but they assume a genotype that's totally free of mutations that has fitness 1. And there's a mutation rate, U, away from this. And everything that mutates away has got worse fitness. And I'm not going to go through their model in any detail. I don't remember their model. And, you know, there can be mutations beyond that, but I think the critical thing here is there is no way back. So mutations happen, your fitness goes down, it stays down, you never recover. And so they derive a very simple recursion. This is the one that Nick set up, and I want to actually write it out. So the frequency of the next generation, the frequency of the previous generation times the number of babies times under a Poisson model that we get no mutations in the offspring, and we divide by W bar. Now, in their paper, they focused on one of the two solutions to this, which I think was appropriate for the model they were considering, which was at equilibrium, W bar equals e to the minus u. So, and Nick put that up on Monday. This is, I think, a very useful, potentially useful result. It's the kind of result that an empiricist likes because there's not much in it, right? So we don't have to make too many measurements. And as Nick said, this thing is insensitive to mutation size, to epistasis, all kinds of things. It's absolutely wonderful. From our perspective, there are two downsides. One is you may take a very long time to get there, even close, right? Like almost forever. It really depends. That depends on the effect size. And in our system, we're going to have recombination. This assumes no recombination, so we're just going to have to suck that up and live with it. So there's that result. Now, about 5 years later, Eigen, and then Eigen and Schuster published paper, and they're working with a very specific, oh, and let me draw this thing out. So I want to go to, so we got mutation right here, W bar here, one, A, it, no, sorry, it doesn't fit there, it keeps going like that. So,
it's fine if there's recombination or epistasis, you just can't have both.
Okay, thank you. That makes it seem even more robust from my perspective. So now we have Eigen and Schuster, and they're working with a very specific version of this particular model. Again, they've got this, what they call a master sequence. Mutation takes you off that. There's no way back again. But now you're going into a neutral network. Etc. And I, you know, these are all the same fitness, less than that. Once you get in there, you're stuck. And I think in the simple model, there was no, you didn't ever leave that as well. And what they showed was you can, they addressed actually the other solution to this equation. And so consider mutation rate, now the equilibrium frequency of this guy, they showed at some point it goes out of the population. It disappears, right? And this is a fairly trivial result presented this way. This became known as the error catastrophe. Now, if you could have chosen a more misleading term for virologists than that, I dare you to come up with it. Because catastrophe was well understood in mathematics circles as to what it meant. But to a virologist, this sounded like something horrible happening to the population.
The term actually has a history in biology which is older than that. I think it was first proposed by Leslie Argel in his theory of aging. And there he spoke of translational errors back in the early 60s. So Eigen borrowed it from there.
Ah, okay. So there was a basis for it. Well, virologists still...
It was misguided anyhow, but for a longer time. But he was not the one to propose it first.
So anyway, this has seemed like something bad ever since. And in fact, it's not. That what is happening in this on this diagram is, people often equate this with population extinction. Error catastrophe, things go to hell, we're done. But if you actually plot out what's happening here, wherever the error catastrophe is in this simple model, your fitness now does that. It plateaus. And this type of result has been now re-derived by several people in several different contexts. And they all have the property that an error, what we call an error catastrophe now, is a change from a high fitness, mutationally sensitive genotype to one that is a somewhat lower fitness, but robust. It's the evolution of robustness. And in this context, mutational robustness, when you've got high mutation rate, there is a fitness advantage of mutational robustness that can offset a lower intrinsic fitness, if you want to call it that. So my colleague and Igor's collaborator, Klaus Wilke, has sort of renamed this, I think a much more appropriate name, and they call it survival of the flattest. And that's really what it's about. So it's not about extinction. So which brings us to then to this next topic, what is lethal mutagenesis and what is that about? And the way I'm going to use it here is extinction. Now, and it's going to be deterministic extinction. Phil Garish is here next week. I think he uses this in a somewhat different context. But we're just going to use it as extinction. And to connect all of these things together, I think we all realize that extinction is a demographic process, right? If I tell you what the mean fitness of something is, you can't say whether it's going to go extinct or not until you know how many babies are produced, right? Extinction means that you have fewer in the offspring generation than you had in the parent generation, and that this has to continue in some fashion indefinitely until you're out of parents. And so we need a fecundity term. So W bar is, say, a relative fitness. We need a fecundity term in there. Now, Paul Snagowski works with bacteria. It's clear what the fecundity is, but with, let's say, a virus, we have to deal with something like a burst size, the number of babies released at the time, and we need an effective number of burst size, how many of those goes on to start new infections. But we can certainly say a very strict criterion for extinction is that the fecundity, which would be measured in the absence of mutations, times mean fitness is less than one. And you can come up with more realistic and more complicated models to deal with. There's no reason to have to be linear like this, etc. But I just want to make the point here that extinction can be thought of as a combination of a fecundity or an ecological term, if you will, and a genetic term. And if there's going to be any generality here, it's going to be in this, right? This thing's going to change from situation to situation. And what it says is that I might take the same drug, the same mutagenesis regime, and go from one situation where the viral fecundity is high and not cause extinction, but if I go to another setting where the fecundity is low, I might achieve extinction. Right? So the generality here, if there's going to be any, lies in that, and that's what I want to focus on in the rest of the talk. And I'm going to use this as sort of a target that we go for. How general is that when we start getting into realistic situations? So I think that's about time. And I want to acknowledge that the assumptions that go in here are general in some ways, but specific in others. We're going to be violating the nonsense out of a lot of this. We're going to be dealing with recombination, finite populations. We're not necessarily starting. We usually don't know that we're starting with the best adapted genotype for the environment. So we just have to live with that, and we're going to ask, does this even get us close? So I was told all I'll do is push this button. Thank you, Sal. So we're going to So I don't know why that's not working. Was it working before? So I want to start with this talking about a simulation model, and I can explain this as clear as can be, but it would help if you could see this. So does anyone know why this isn't showing up?
Someone on the second floor is watching this video, and they're running down here at this moment.
So we're.
But if you have an idea about the
work, so well, I can keep talking, but we will run to a point where.
Jim, is that your attachment dongle?
Yes.
Not theirs. Okay, good.
That is correct. Detect this. Anyway, while they're helping out. I'm going to start with a simulation model, discrete generation. So we're forced, the results I've talked about are deterministic. We're forced into a finite population size here, and not a very big one. Discrete generations, and rather than sort of specify directly fitness distributions, fitness effects, we're going to use a model that was originally developed by Walter Fontana, which assumes it's kind of a black box model, but it has a number of properties we like. And we're going to pretend that our individuals are RNA molecules, 99 bases long, and their phenotype's going to be the minimum free energy fold that we get out of a program called M-fold. We're then going to compare, so then we fold up a molecule. To get its fitness, we compare it to a target shape, we count the number of differences, and we just make the fitness a linear, decaying linear function of differences from optimum. Now, the work here is done by a grad student named Thomas Keller, and Klaus and I kind of looked over his shoulder while this was going on.
Does a target minimum free energy?
So the target is just some shape, and that could be achieved, it can be achieved by this molecule. We're going to actually start with, I guess the next slide. We're going to start with everyone in the population folding into the optimal shape. So the optimal shape can be achieved. One of the downsides that I don't like about this is the reason this works easily is because you can represent the shape as a string of dots and right and left parentheses. And so you just line these, you line your target shape up with the folded shape of the molecule and you count the number of differences. Other than zero differences, the minimum is 2. So a single base change creates 2. I don't like that, but maybe I'll live with it. So why do we like this landscape? And the reason gets at something that Sally's been working on for a number of years, but it allows fitness effects to evolve. So those things can change as the population moves. We've got genetic neutrality within the shape. We got compensatory evolution. By the way, green are the good things, brown are the bad things from our perspective. It's still going to be the case that this is unfortunately an overly simple genome, right? It's like we got one phenotype, 99 bases, and we got this stochastic element that we wish we could get rid of.
Why is stochastic element bad?
We're trying to test a deterministic model, and we're going to run into possibly the ratchet here, and I just assume get rid of the ratchet. So, even though that may be realistic. So protocol, we're going to pick a mutation rate, pick a fitness function, which is essentially one parameter of the slope.
Okay, so along those lines, so running it with a bigger population would take too long?
Yeah, that's what happens, yes. I mean, we can get up to 10,000, but we can't do nearly as much. We start everyone with the optimal fold, so we're trying to match the Kimura-Maruyama model. We've imposed a mutation rate, right? But that's not the deleterious mutation rate because some of the mutations are neutral, some are potentially beneficial, not when we start, but as we go on. So we have to calculate the deleterious fraction, and then we're going to multiply that times the mutation rate to get the thing we need to fit. So then we fit to that. We start with things that are simple. As I said, I'm interested in sort of very broad spectrum, sort of, I tend to think of them as zero order results rather than first or second. And so we start out where the minimum deviation in fold hammers you down 30% in fitness, right? It's huge. We do this, we find that the Kimura-Maruyama model is supported quite well. That is, we retain the optimal fold in the population. Down to the point it goes extinct. I'm not going to deal with extinction. The data here consists of the dots. The lines are the fits by a couple different measures of the deleterious fraction. So we get as close to exact fit as we might imagine. The one thing that's not evidenced from this is we've cheated a bit. Yes?
You're sort of only exploring like one or maybe two step mutations here, I suppose.
You mean the population is, yes. Yeah. So things are just getting flushed out fast, and that's why it works. There is, compensatory mutations are arising, but they're just disappearing faster than they can come in. But the one way we've cheated is this. If we were to do this as an empiricist, we would measure the deleterious fraction in the starting genotype, and then we'd make our fit because people have enough work to do your evolution and then do all these measurements. What happens is pretty much the first step here is the molecule we start with, which has the optimal fold, has a particular deleterious fraction that can be improved on. And so the population actually wanders around maintaining the optimal shape and it goes over to something that's more robust. It's not an air catastrophe because we're not going down in intrinsic fitness, but it's going to something more robust. When we get to that and we do the calculation, everything fits. So this tells us, okay, maybe the model's capturing some of what we want. Now let's go to something more realistic. We go to a shallower landscape, a shallower fitness function, S equals 0.05. And if we, by the way, if we try and go much lower than that, the model turns into nonsense because random sequences have reasonable fitness. So that's about the lower limit that we can fit and believe in. Here the optimal shape is lost, except at the very lowest mutation rates. Here are the processes we think are probably going on, we have evidence are going on, or we're just guessing. The loss of the optimal shape might be due to the ratchet. It could also be a form of evolution or robustness. And the only way I can think of doing this gets back, I think it was Daniel's point, that the only way I can imagine to separate these is to actually increase the population or change the population size and see if sort of the onset of the loss of the shape changes. And that would suggest it's a ratchet rather than robustness. We've tried that a little bit, but not enough. So if any of you have a clue how we can sort of, if there's another way of looking at a phenomenon like this and saying this is the evolution of robustness, I would like to know about that.
So I'm sorry, Jim, but the second hypothesis is just what you sketched over there. It says it's a better deal to give up.
That's correct.
Peak because I'm mutationally more robust, right, even though I lost fitness.
That's correct. So it's hard to tell these two apart when all this mess is going on.
Your definition of evolution of robustness is keeping the fitness, but decreasing deleterious fraction. So basically,
So that's a good question, because air catastrophe isn't keeping fitness, right? It's evolving robustness while you're losing intrinsic fitness.
But I thought that you're trying to distinguish your evolution of robustness, so therefore you keep the fitness.
I'm going to phone a friend here, Sally.
I'm just wondering if you can choose your optimal type to be the one that would have the most robustness.
We could do that.
If it went down.
Ooh, that's a simple way of doing it. Good.
But I don't quite get it. Isn't natural selection necessarily focusing on the fittest one? I mean, robustness is kind of a population property then, right?
But we don't, this is a finite population, so that's the downside of the simulation, is if we had an infinite population, there would be no question. Right. So this could be a stochastic effect. It could be that we're finding the fittest type and, you know, we lose the best genotype deterministically, but it happens to be in a finite population. So that would be one, I think, based on what he said, we could still have evolution of robustness in a classic air catastrophe by going to some other region of the space. Yes.
But ultimately it's a mutation selection balance where you also have back mutations into sort of more fit states at some point. You know, as when you go further away from the optimum, the rate of back mutations or available beneficial mutation becomes higher and you're gonna settle on your slope there where these two things match up.
Right. But then if the ratchet is compounded on this, then the ratchet could be pushing you even further.
Well, the ratchet is sort of sliding down, and then there's back mutations.
Yes.
That's sort of basically.
But I guess the question is, what's determining the point where we are? What are the differences?
That's the mutation spectrum balance.
Yeah, exactly.
But so then clarify for me, why can't the ratchet be pushing you even further away? Because the ratchet is not classic mutation selection balance.
At some point, it's
mutations, right?
Yeah, at some point,
I'm going to get to that in a couple slides, maybe one slide.
At some point, there's no back mutations. That's not a ratchet anymore. It slides in both directions.
Yeah. Tend to think of this as you're sliding in both directions. So the ratchet is pushing you, but you're being pushed back.
Yes, yeah, not a real ratchet.
The ratchet is transient, right? It's only at the beginning and then.
So anyway, well, I think we're all saying the same thing. So here's what's happening. This actually agrees very much with what Sally and Art Poon were publishing over a decade ago. But as you go to higher and higher mutation rates, You're changing where you are in the fitness landscape, your deleterious fraction going down, you now have the potential for this, for beneficial mutations. And then all of you, I think, have by now anticipated this outcome. This is time courses of runs at different mutation rates. Ignore the little dotted curve, but I guess you can read that. But we're going from a low mutation rate to a moderately high mutation rate, and everything's starting at one, right? And it's just collapsing very quickly and going into a quasi-intermediate. So we do have this two things going on. We have compensatory evolution bringing you back up, and we have these other processes, whatever they are, ratchet mutation selection balance, pushing you in another direction. So we go to a quasi-equilibrium. We'll ask two questions. One is, how does, if we try and fit Kimura Maruyama to this, what do we get? And the dots are the data. The line is the calculated fit, which I suppose technically should be dots. We see,
you're using these empirically determined deleterious mutations.
And one problem with that is the model, Kimura Maruyama, is specifically about the mutation rate away from the best genotype. We don't have the best genotype in these populations anymore, so we're taking a population average, and there may be difficulties with that.
So in some sense, there are more, there in these genomes, there are more deleterious mutations than you think from counting, and that's why the slope is steeper. Is that fair to say?
That's why the points are below the line?
Yeah.
I think so.
The little d is actually larger. You could work backwards and say, I'm going to assume it's exponential, I'm going to fit a line, and I'm going to read the slope and divide by big U. What's that d? And that d will be bigger than the one you got by just looking point by point.
Yeah,
I don't quite know where that brings us, but is that a fair way of saying it?
I didn't follow that well enough.
I'm sorry.
To be able to answer, but let's do a different comparison here. Let's forget Kimura Maruyama. Let's just compare the fitnesses we get in the shallow and the steep landscape, where we know the steep one's fitting and this one isn't, and we end up with actually a slight superiority as we get to higher mutation rates of fitness in the shallow landscape. This would be some, you know, if someone wants to jump in here and say, oh, it's obvious why this is happening, I'd love it. And by the way, from my perspective as an empiricist, these two curves are identical. So it doesn't matter, right? Absolutely not. So anyway, you can think about that. But that's kind of where we were with the simulation study. And at this point, I sort of feel semi-confident that we're not totally off base trying to use this. Now, there's no recombination here, and when we go to the viral system, there is going to be recombination, and maybe Nick or Sally can sort of help say how that's going to change things, or Daniel, because we don't know anything about epistasis in the system. But so we're now going to talk about a bacteriophage called T7. We're going to grow this virus in culture. Cells, add phage, I'll talk about the protocol in a minute. We're going to grow at an elevated mutation rate by adding a chemical to that culture. And we're going to look at fitness evolution, and we'll look at sequence evolution. The phage is T7, so when Santi yesterday was sort of slobbering over the thought of a phage called T4 and how pretty it was, T7 is sort of approaching that, but it's sort of stubby. It's got a really short tail, but other than that, it's kind of, you know, you put a longer tail in there and you got something. It looks like T4. Details about its genome that are absolutely irrelevant here, but it's got a double-stranded DNA genome. It's about 40 kilobases long, 60 genes or so. It's fairly modular, so it's the things Santi works on have all kinds of overlapping genes in that. And these are mostly separate. So that's a much prettier genome than yours. And it's got its own RNA polymerase and promoters, and that's very unusual, actually, among phages. Most phages do not encode their own RNA polymerase.
And mutation rate is?
The thought is it's, you know, like on the order of 1 in 100 replications. So, I mean, that's just using Drake's estimate, but it's not terribly high. And we're going to push it to 6. So we're going to push it many orders of magnitude here. Now, this overlaps somewhat with Sandy, what Sandy was talking about yesterday, but the life cycle is we got a virion, we got a cell, it attaches, the genome goes in, it's going to transcribe and translate, then it starts doing things. It makes its own genome, T7 chews up the host genome, T7 shuts down the host transcription, you assemble viruses, and then you lyse. And lyse, I worked on phages for about 10 years before I realized lysis is not just the cell saying, I give up. This is under very strict control by the phage. The phage cares a lot about when it blows that cell open, and it's just absolutely saltatory. You can be looking at these things under a microscope and they just disappear. Right? But it's very strict control, and so you're done with the cycle. Yes?
Is it a lysogeny? Yes.
It is not a lysogen. Good point. It's strictly lytic. So the only thing it can do is it goes into the cell, and if it lives, is blow the thing open. The cell is absolutely dead. But even if it was a lysogenic phage, it wouldn't matter. We're doing a serial transfer experiment. So we have cells at a particular state. We add phage. We grow for a while. We then transfer the culture. And by the way, we don't kill everything. We just transfer whatever state we've achieved there into the next one, into the next one. And so we're kind of mimicking a vast expansion of the phage population here. We're selecting for rapid growth of the phage. So hosts are not limiting. They're not being allowed to co-evolve. Even if it was a lysogenic phage and foreign lysogens in here, they wouldn't grow fast enough to matter in the transfer, but it's irrelevant. We do introduce bottlenecks, but we set it up so we transfer about 100,000. So the bottlenecks are not like Santi was talking about yesterday, of, you know, 1 or 10 individuals. They're large population transfers. We can control recombination to some extent by whether we, how long we let this go. And in this experiment, we actually let these go a long time. So when the culture lyses, it means that lots of cells have been co-infected. Now, co-infected cell figure, I think it's about 5 breakpoints, recombinations per genome on average. So there's recombination at the end of the cycle and the titer built up. And a problem that will haunt us later is the mutagen alters the environment. So by adding the mutagen to the environment, we're affecting all the phage parameters, and we kind of have to, it means we can't relate it back very well to the environment without mutagen.
Did anyone directly measure recombination of T7?
They have. And so it's, I've been told, I didn't do it, but I've been told that if you get 2 co-infecting phage, they'd have to be at the same time. In the 40 KB, the average genome you get out has about, I guess, 5 breakpoints. So 5 across 40 KB. It could be about a half an order of magnitude. You don't need to. Whether you follow this or not, it isn't going to be critical to the rest of the talk, but we model fitness here as exponential growth, and which would be R, and so the equation is transcendental. We can solve it numerically, but the growth rate of the phage depends on 3 phage parameters, which are in purple for phage. So we have a burst size B, a lysis time, which is assumed invariant, by the way, L, that's in minutes, and we have an absorption rate constant, which you were asking the question yesterday, Asante. This runs to be about on the order of 10 to the minus 9 min per mil. So it's on a minute basis and a per mil. And then we have the cell density. So if we know those things, in theory, we can calculate what the growth rate should be. Doesn't always work so well. In this system now, this is not wild type T7 without mutagen. This is with mutagen. We have different ways of getting at the mutation rate. The total mutation rate, we think, is about 6 per genome per infection cycle. That's fairly sloppy. There's, I mean, technically we can handle it, but basically we have to sequence a whole population of viruses at the end. And we can get, I think, better estimates of the viable mutation rate. That's just doing a mutation accumulation study. And that looks like it's about 4.3. What we don't have in this system is the deleterious fraction of mutations. But thanks to the thanks to Spain. Savi's former student, Rafa San Juan, has estimated this for two different bacteriophages. And then if you look at Savi's numbers yesterday, he had two different numbers. And so we're going to plug in a 0.6 for the fraction of viable mutations that are deleterious. But everything on which these estimates are based is small, and our genome is something like 8 times bigger. So that could be way off. Plug these things in into the equation. We know, I mean, we measure initial fitness. It's sitting just under 20. This is doublings per hour, by the way. So that means one phage. 20 would mean one phage turns into about a millionth an hour later. The prediction for fitness, you know, when we, if this equation works, if we carry this study out long enough, our fitness should be down there. And I think, kind of regardless of our background here, we can all agree that this is not a success. There's a general rule I've evolved to over years in the lab, and that is, if the first time you try an experiment, it works the way you think it did, you think it should, then you probably did something wrong. Oh, that this makes me feel good then when I see it.
It's not enough of purple, that's the problem.
So anyway, it's about 200 generations. We actually took a measurement. So when I saw this result, I thought, we did do a measurement here, and the fitness was down a little bit, but not very much from the initial. So it might have taken a dip and gone back up. So when that doesn't fit, what do? Well, you gather some other kinds of data. And so one of the questions is, well, did we really do anything to the genome? And the answer is yes. If we look at the endpoint population, we sequence it using this next-gen technology, which is wonderful. We sort of get these reads from, you know, the whole population. So we don't know what's going on in any single genome, but we get these reads and, you know, get whatever it is, 50, 100x coverage. And we can go through each position in the genome and say, how many mutations do we see at this site? We know what the wild type sequence is, right? So we just look and say, okay, this differs from the wild type and 2 out of 80 reads or something like that. We can then go through the genome and break it up into how common is the mutation, and then we just sort of say, well, if we put a whole genome together with all these averages, how many mutations would the average genome carry, mutations that are in the frequency of 5% or less, 5 to 10, 10 to 20, and so on, and we get this distribution. If we just say, let's set a threshold of mutations that are at frequency of 25% or less in the population, we estimate there's about, each genome is carrying about 245 of those, and the fitness went up. Now, if you look at this, this has kind of an ideal property. Now, I think all of us are probably surprised that we got lots of mutations that are that common in the population. You know, I would have expected a much taller spike here and it goes down faster, but whatever. Anyway, some of you are probably already looking out at this part of the distribution, right? So this thing should just dive down to here if it's all mutation selection balanced. We have on the order of 30, it's about 28 mutations in the categories that are 80% or higher.
I don't think I fully understood what's plotted there.
Okay, so.
So you measure.
We have a whole population here. We're not looking at individual.
Chopped up into individual reads in your deep sequencing thing.
Yes.
So at each site, you know, there's each site you can say how much wild type, how much mutant I see.
We can bin them then, right? So if we got 100-fold coverage, we, you know, see, okay, this mutation, we only saw it once in 100 reads. This one we saw 4. We're going to stack them up. So now we get these data for each position in the genome, and then we just scan across the whole genome and say, let's sum all of these up across the genome. And so out of 40 KB, how many mutations do we have that we saw that were only at 5% or less? And so it's certainly the type of shape we expect, but I would not try and argue that you know, we should see so many. I mean, 10% is a bloody high frequency, frankly. But you know, if you're hitting it with enough mutagen, maybe okay. Yeah.
So didn't you say you're selecting for higher growth? So aren't you expecting lots of beneficial mutations there as well?
It depends on whether that's possible, right? So you're selecting for higher growth, but the wild type doesn't grow very badly to begin with. So if it's possible for the phage to, you know, evolve higher fitness in this environment, then yes, you expect some anyway. But we don't have any expectation for that. So
I don't know lots about this phage, but I would have thought that it's not. The wild type is not necessarily adapted to the fastest possible growth.
It's so if we, I can address that, but let me get your question first.
Actually, a related question. So what does one know about the variability of growth of a phage? Does it depend on the temperature?
Everything.
So precisely. So for example, well, I guess what I'm asking is, are there some well-controlled situations where you can depress the growth of your very rapidly proliferating phage? You know, so are there resistant bacteria?
Well, we can get a host that kills it. We can. I mean, there are.
I don't want to kill it. But are there somewhat resistant bacteria?
Yes. We can knock the tail fiber off the phage, and then it doesn't. I mean, it'll still infect actually, but the growth rate goes down. We can put it in minimal media, the growth rate goes down. So you're thinking change the design so that there's sort of...
So give it, for example, a little bit more room to adapt so that it becomes a little...
So, and we have...
More plausible.
So you're both getting at the same question, but from different ends, okay? So I'll just say that we've taken a virus that is really well adapted to this environment, but without mutagen. And we measure the initial fitness. It's significantly, but very slightly above what we have with the wild type. The problem is still that the mutagen is profoundly altering the environment. You put the cells are going like this, you add mutagen, the density is doing this mutagen, and they just flatten out. Phages do not grow well if the cell is unhappy. And so, you're correct in raising this question, but we're screwed because there's nothing we can do about it with this particular mutagen.
So those fitness assays are in the presence of the mutagen?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that is a nice little point.
Have you checked them in the absence of it?
No.
At the end?
No, I don't think so. But anyway, so we're all thinking the same lines here. These are probably signatures of adaptation out here, right? I mean, you're not going to, unless they're neutral, but it's only 200 generations. So let's look at those. Where are they in the genome? And draw threshold 75%. Mutation's got to be 75% or more to appear on this. The height of the line is the frequency. This, and so at each point we found one of those high frequency mutations, we draw a vertical line. The height is the frequency we see it at. This is the position along the genome. There are 28 of these things. They're almost all clustered right there. Guess what that part of the genome does? DNA metabolism. About half of them are in the DNA polymerase, which is what you expect. You know, you throw ribavirin at poliovirus, its polymerase, replicase, whatever you want to call it, evolves resistance, etc. So this undoubtedly represents, you know, a plausible form of resistance evolution. And so we're in a situation where what could be going on is this. These are not data other than, I guess, this point and this point. But this is a possible explanation for what's going on. So this is what I showed you before. Here's a starting fitness, here's a predicted one, here's the observed fitness. If we sort of say, well, what would it take to fit the Kimura-Maruyama model in terms of starting fitness, we'd end up with a fitness of about 33 doublings per hour. That's not totally implausible. If we do this in the absence of mutagen, this virus gets up to 48 doublings per hour. Just to put this in perspective, this would mean that one phage can fill the Pacific Ocean at 10 to the ninth per mil in 3.5 hours. So it grows fast.
Did the virus change its mutation rate in the presence?
We didn't. So we didn't do that, and we can't really look at that for a reason I'll tell you in a minute.
So did you tell us what the mutagen was?
I did not tell you what it was.
How does it act?
It's nitrosiguanine. It's a well-known mutagen used in microbiology, and it induces mostly GC to AT changes.
In bacteria and in the virus?
Yes, it does.
In both, okay.
But we're changing the bacteria out every cycle, but the cells hate it. So I'm going to have to. Someone's going to have to remind me of your question.
So if you go back one slide and you saw the allele frequency plots, if there's a lot of recombination, it looks like there's a hitch hiking event going on there.
There probably is.
So that you have this, you can kind of identify the driver.
I agree with you. So one thing I forgot to mention is if you look at these amino acid coding or silent mutations, about half of them are silent. When we do an adaptation normally and we see bunches of changes, over 90% are coding changes. So I think the fact that we're getting such a, so many silent changes here implies there's a lot of impact going on. So yes, not all of them are likely to be beneficial, but certainly there's some beneficial ones going on there. Now, your question.
It was whether the virus changed.
So has the virus changed mutation rate? So could we just go into the final population and answer that question? And the answer is probably not. And the reason for that. Is this. If we think about the Kimura-Maruyama model, which clearly doesn't apply here because with an average of 250 mutations per genome, there ain't nothing that's going to be mutation free. But it's kind of a, we have this population that is now, if we were to plot the distribution of it, there's not very much of the wild type left, so I don't know how, but let's say the wild type's here, number of mutations is here, so we've got this distribution of the population that looks like that. To measure the relevant mutation rate for this is going to be probably at this end of the distribution, right? These things are chock full of mutations, deleterious mutations, so everything in that population, almost everything we pull out is going to have deleterious mutations in the DNA polymerase gene. And so what the mutation rate here isn't going to be terribly relevant. And there's no way to sort of sample the population other than you want to do this thousands of times and really get an idea what the relevant mutation rate is at the end of the population.
So I got this idea looking at the mutations that you said maybe were resistant to this mutagen. And what does resistance mean? To me, it means that the mutagen cannot work to mutate anymore.
Okay. Biochemically, probably the more important effect of the mutagen is that it's stopping elongation. That the polymerase gets on and starts transcribing and it craps out. And so it could be that the polymerase is evolving to actually elongate completely regardless of the mutation rate. We don't know. But potentially we could. So these are the common ones, right? If we take any virus out of the population and sequence this, we're going to find other mutations in there. The way to sort of get a handle on what you're after is to use synthetic biology, synthesize this thing, and then ask what the mutation rate is. I'm going to get at this a different way in a minute that'll throw water on the whole thing.
Wait, could you use the whole population? And just look at the consensus sequence of, or that's how much mutations come out in the next step.
Again, that's not relevant because at least in the quasi-species model, what's driving the whole thing is the best types. And so even if the mutation rate is horribly high in the lower part, that isn't going to be relevant to the fitness that's maintained in the population. I mean, the system really is. The 20 doublings per hour, whatever the fitness is can be driven by a very small class of the population. Yes.
Trivial question. Could you move your laptop down to the table so you can see the x-axis of every slide? Thank you.
I prefer to obscure the x-axis of the entire audience. anyway, so these are, by the way, these numbers are just gene numbers here. But this is the genome laid out. So we have to throw up our hands. That could be going on. We can. I mentioned earlier in response, I think, to your question that if we take a virus that's well adapted to this environment, minus mutagen, measure its fitness, it sits about there. If there's one other thing we can try, and we did it kind of a little better than half-assed, but not much, we have the option of redoing this, and this now gets at your question. We can freeze the DNA polymerase so it doesn't evolve. And the way we do that is we take a phage, we knock out the DNA polymerase gene, and so the phage is dead, right? But if you put it on the plasmid in the host, now the phage will grow, but the DNA polymerase gene is dead every cycle, and so it can't evolve anymore. And so we did this when I saw those results, and I thought, And the effect of this is it actually knocks the fitness way down just because of the fact that it doesn't have the gene in its genome anymore and that its fitness is down, so there should be more opportunity. We only took this out 100 generations instead of 200. We didn't see any fitness. But it was the first time we did it, so I realized it. Exactly what should happen.
No one has ever done that without the mutagen, has it?
I haven't yet, but I'm fixing to. We actually now also have a DNA polymerase gene that's got a mock-up in the proofreading domain. So we're going to be able to do this perhaps with less mutagen.
Is there a mutagen that you could use in the transfer stage when there's less, I would imagine, maybe less
So that is possible, but then the question is the transfer. Remember, going through multiple generations within each culture, and then the other thing you'd be doing is destroying the stable age distribution of infection. So the exponential growth assumption goes away when you do that. So I've thought about doing that. Ideally, you'd like a mutagen that doesn't go inside the cell. I mean, the best thing would be a mutagen the cell doesn't mind at all. And there is one for Q beta. This is what Lazaro is working on, called AZC. Okay, so the dust settles. We look at these results. It's of absolutely no consequence to industry, right? I mean, industry wouldn't have cared how this thing came out. You know, a drug company trying to market a drug, they want something that works, they don't care how it works and so on, so I don't think they really care about this. And, you know, and it's interesting, but I don't think it's the most important issue with respect to lethal mutagenesis. If we're actually going to use it in society, I think the bigger question is, if it isn't going to work all the time, and by the way, ribavirin only helps cure the infection, I think, about 50% of the time. So people are, you know, being exposed to this drug or mutating virus, it's not curing the infection. This does, going back to this particular equation, e to the minus mu, is that, you know, will partial or incomplete lethal mutagenesis at least knock fitness down and help keep it down, even if we don't get extinction, or could it make things worse? Could we evolve a superbug by, you know, creating a more mutated population? Let's say we're sitting on a fitness peak here, we got this valley over here, we got this peak here. The population would not normally make the jump, but now when we elevate its mutation rate 10 or 100 fold, bang, it jumps up there. That is probably the most relevant question to ask here, and there's no single study that's going to answer that, right? It's, we're going to have to look at a lot of different contexts. So I'm just going to, and I got two slides left, but I'm going to look at one study which suggests maybe it's not going to be that much of a problem. So this is just taking a related phage to G7 and saying, let's try and move it to a new host. And the reason for doing that is because by moving it to no host, we think there's actually a lot of room for fitness improvement, and maybe the path towards that new peak matters a lot. So we did this. We didn't do this, by the way, to test anything to do with lethal mutagenesis. We set up four different protocols. We did the normal serial transfer for about 200 generations, so just like before with T7, but no mutagen. We did serial transfer for a little bit longer with mutagenesis every fourth cycle. We did a very long-term one in a different environment, but still kind of similar to this, for 1,200 generations, and then we did a combination of these two things. Now, if mutation rate is limiting, makes a profound difference, or if amount of time makes a profound difference, then these three adaptations here should come out with higher, any or all of them should come out with higher fitness than that. And that's not what we saw. Everything's about the same. This is a starting guy, so it was actually already partly adapted to the host. And these are the four treatments here. This one, which you have no way of knowing, is the serial passage, just the normal boring stuff. The one with mutagen, the serial passage is here, and these are the other two. The differences up there are not significant. When you compare tests, we could do more replicates, and they might come out significant. But by and large, everything's going up about 12 kilograms per hour, which is a huge effect. And whatever differences are up there aren't really profound.
But the mutagen ones didn't start out much worse than the non-mutagen ones?
We started with the same thing.
But didn't they have a harder time living in the mutagen environment?
Not necessarily. Well, yes, and so we lowered the dose of mutagen to where they weren't having a harder time.
So they were at about, they started about the same number of ducklings per hour?
Oh, probably not. But
so they gained more. They evolved more than the...
So back to the point Dan made earlier. All of these fitnesses are estimated, measured in the mutation-free environment. They're all measured in the same endpoint environment. So even with this mutagenized line, three of the four passages were done without mutagen. So this is all measured now in a common environment. It's sort of like we gave them a boost with mutation, but we're asking them to perform in the same environment, and they're all exposed mostly to that environment throughout. And actually, when we got to the end, we actually grew this another 10 hours without any mutagen at all. So it's a comparable measure across these. The other thing, and one bizarre thing was, I'm used to sort of, when you do these phage experiments, I'm used to getting a lot of parallel evolution, seeing a lot of the same changes. Not here. This line accumulated about 7 changes during its adaptation. One of these others were 33. There's very little in common. And so I thought, maybe they're all kind of not quite there yet. So we took all four of these, recombined them, mixed them together, outgrew them for a while, and then measured the recombinant, the adapted recombinant's fitness in the same environment. It wasn't any higher as well. So it looks like there's probably some kind of fitness limit in this system that's due to intrinsic properties of how the genome's put together, not terribly sensitive to sort of this fine scale mutational landscape. And if that's generally the case, then it would say that, mutagenesis isn't going to create a superbug. But I think we can all think of scenarios where it would matter. Like if you're under a highly active antiretroviral treatment with HIV, where you're relying on a low mutation rate of HIV, it might be the use of a mutagenic thing would actually accelerate the virus thing. So this is just one tiny bit of the relevant landscape that we need to explore.
Even here, the fitness assay is just kind of limited, right? And you could easily have a difference of several doublings an hour, which would be maybe significant and very significant. You can't measure it.
I'm actually, this is back to the zero order effects. So in evolution, a doubling per hour would be profound over thousands of generations. But when I'm dealing with magnitudes of this, I don't care about a couple doublings per hour.
But that's what I'm saying. For evolution, it can make a huge difference and still be outside the bounds of what the experiment can measure.
Yes.
So I'm little confused. So you would expect that if you have a mutagen, your increase of fitness would be faster. So is this after a very long time that you're saying that everything sort of saturates to the same
increase? This was 200 generations. So yes, so if we'd done this for 10 generations, you might have seen an effect. But if you're thinking of a virus in a human population like flu or whatever, you're probably in the order of hundreds to thousands of generations. So again, you might undoubtedly would see a short-term effect, but there's only so much.
No. Did you keep any of your intermediates?
Oh, yes.
Early generation? So one could actually go back and look at how fast it started gaining.
Yeah, it's written up, but we haven't published it yet. But yes, you could do that. But I probably would try and do this in a little more controlled fashion. Then you have the problem of the number of how do you scale number of generations? Because when you're in the presence of mutagen, that generation time may slow down again. But yes, you could do it. And so, what would you predict? Actually, that's what I like doing: is asking people to predict where I'll know the answer.
Well, obviously not on the top of my head, but right, we were certainly, in fact, heard quite a few talks about the rate of evolution and how it depends on population size, in this case controlled by bottleneck, and rate of recombination, which here can also presumably be controlled by...
Within bounds, yes.
Well, but presumably by just changing... the ratio of
you can transfer before you get to
precisely, and you can you're saying that cells are not limiting, but you could limit it by cells, right? And then basically force it more into a perhaps recombinant regime. Of course, one would want to have some probably direct means of measuring it, at least to calibrate.
But would you generally expect that pulsing with mutation would lead to higher rate of adaptation? All else equal?
Sure. Well, it depends on the initial conditions, right?
On the intrinsic mutation rate, how many different mutations can get you?
Assuming that you have suppressed your fitness initially, that you're adapting to some new environment, the question is, does it... is it proportional to mutation rate, or is it can be quite independent of mutation rate, right? If we're in a sort of seriously saturating regime, large population, et cetera, right?
Yeah, so it's really an empirical question of where do we lie with the normal virus for all of these parameters, and then boosting the mutation rate may or not matter. And with HIV, it may be the boosting the mutation rate.
But I guess what I'm arguing for is unfolding this experiment a little bit by varying the parameters.
Yes, and also just going back and seeing what the trajectories look like. Agreed. So I'm done.